Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and your professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my genuinely amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% globally, this podcast really is a must-listen. So whether you're tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. Today is an exciting continuation from a previous episode called Dr. Bridget Cooper, Becoming Unflappable. And today we're going to dive deeper into the world of leadership with Dr. Bridget Cooper. She is affectionately known as Dr. B. And if you're just joining us, Bridget is a seasoned leadership expert with over 30 years of experience empowering individuals and organizations to reach their full potential. Now, her friendly demeanor and down-to-earth approach might surprise you, given her genuinely impressive credentials, which include a doctorate in leadership and so many others. But her mission is to demystify complex problems and infuse humor into challenging situations, and that makes them feel more manageable for everyone involved. And I'll get her to tell you about the books because she's got several. But today I am going back to Unflappable, the book that we started talking about the last time she was here, How Smart People Quit Overthinking, Ditch the Drama, and Thrive at Work. So sit back, relax, and get ready to glean some invaluable insights and actionable advice from a conversation that promises to be an enlightening journey into the world of leadership and personal growth. Bridget, welcome back. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Denise. It's such a pleasure to talk with you and share this voice with you, this time, conversation about leadership and all the things it encompasses. I'm really super excited.
Do me a favor, Bridget. Me too. Me too. I have to kind of warn the audience. I'm losing my voice a bit. I spent the day yesterday, Easter Sunday, in a park, and I'm in the deep south. It's yellow season. There's pollen everywhere, and didn't pay the price, but it was a lovely day. I'm glad we did it. So tell people a bit about your other books, and then let's dive directly into Unflappable, because when you were here last, we talked a lot about why you wrote the book, who you are, how you show up in the world. But then I really wanted to spend today saying, okay, you've got stuff in here that people can go,
let's deep dive into the pages, right?
Let's deep dive into the daily practice.
And I'll carry the lion's share.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll do the lion's share of talking as we agreed to before, so that, forgive Denise if she coughs right on air, because you know what? We're human, and that's part of being unflappable, is not letting that get up in our heads and making it us off balance as a result. So, Unflappable is actually my seventh book. And I have, obviously six before that. I started writing books in 2013. My mission was to kind of share my perspective on where problems come from and how to look at them differently so that you can solve them more empowered. And I, over the last 20 years of being in business, actually this week will mark 20 years that I've been in my own business, doing this leadership and development work with individuals and companies, I have so many tools over those years, that I've used with professional coaching clients, with the companies that I do consulting and training for. And I thought, why aren't all these things in one place? Why are they scattered across the previous six books and in presentations that have never hit a book? Why aren't I putting them all in one place as a resource guide? And that's where the thinking behind Unflappable came from. So it's a toolkit of about 70 tools that are, 2 to 3 pages long, super easy for those of us who are attention deprived and allows us to dig into, again, solving those complex problems with innovative but simple solutions, just shifting our mindset just a smidge, you know, just like when you know you take a ship's course off by a fraction of a degree, you can end up in a completely different part of the world. Same kind of thing with the way that we think about things, interpret behavior, including our own, and, you know, go forward with that.
And I was looking again, listen, I've read this book several times. I think I told you that the last time. I have in my office hundreds of books, and every single book in here was gifted to me by my podcast guests, every single book without exception.
What a great racket you have going on, Denise. I mean, yeah, like, hey, let me just start a podcast so I can have an entire library of free books. Who knew there was that? That's such a great strategy.
It wasn't a plan. But racket, I love that. I'm not talking to you no more. No, it's just over.
But I'm on to you, Denise.
I know you caught me, but and I've got bookcases everywhere, my bedroom, my garage. But these books are gifts, and I've read every single one of them. And I actually have, and I probably have mentioned this before, I have a one shelf that's dedicated to those books that I'm constantly going back to. And yours is in the shelf. I mean, it's right there at eye level. Uh-huh. I could have got it. It's a great book, and it's so helpful. And I'm going to go through the table of contents really quickly, because I want people to grab this book. Grab it for your entrepreneurial library. Grab it for your own peace of mind. But, you know, you talk about stress busters in personal, interpersonal, intrapersonal toolkit, interpersonal toolkit. And with each one of these, you have frameworks, daily practices, and interventions. And I love that. It's broken down so easy to read it, understand it, and take action.
Yeah, that's what I was intending for. You know, the book, when you have 70 tools, my original idea had been to have it be, you know, two pages at a time. So you'd open the book, and on the left side and the right side, that was one tool. And then you'd keep moving on. So you could just flip it to any page and do that and find a tool that might be helpful for you that day. And of course, my you know, my publisher said, I mean, that's cute, but like, no. So they said, you need creative of you, Dr. B, but we're going to go with a hard pass. So, you know, I think that still would have flown. You know, we can agree to disagree. But this structure allowed me to put the different pieces in drawers. And I'm very much I have a very structured brain. And I know a lot of people benefit from having some structure when they're trying to learn new things. And so this sorts each one of those aspects of how to be unflappable into those three pieces, which is foundations, is kind of like frameworks, is, you know, what do you need to understand about stress, or what do you need to understand about intrapersonal conflict, which is the conflict that happens inside your own being, and interpersonal conflict, which is that conflict that happens between people, and how do you need to understand what that is and where it comes from before you can address how to fix it. And so that's the start of each one of those sections. And then I talk about daily practices, which is things, and I know we're going to deeper dive into this, but just to give a framework, the daily practices are things you can be doing every day. If you start instilling these practices in your life every day, you will see the needle move so quickly, dramatically, and effectively. And so those are things that are just part of your daily practice, good habits to have on being unflappable. And then the last section in each one of those breakdowns is interventions, which is, okay, when stuff goes sideways, how do I jump in and fix it? How do I jump in and do something about it? So those are more, yes, they can be daily practices, but they probably won't come up daily. So they are kind of one-offs in their execution. So that's how I set up Unflappable, to make it really easy to navigate. And then there's an index in the back that, if you've ever been to a presentation of mine, or you've heard a podcast, or seen me post about something, and you're like, oh yeah, I want to understand bubbles. I want to understand fear, trust, control dynamic. You can flip right to the back of the book, and you can look that up alphabetically, and it'll point you to the pages in the book that those concepts are mentioned.
Excellent. And you mentioned, or I mispronounced, interpersonal, but We all talk to ourselves. We all have these conversations with ourselves. And I've said this on the radio before. If anybody spoke to me the way that I sometimes speak to myself in a Walmart parking lot, I would need bail money. No doubt about it. I'd be in jail. But I catch
Yeah,
myself
that inner
doing
critic.
it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's
Yeah.
kind of a witch. I don't like her very much. So what
No.
I'm kind of wrote down while you were talking is the role of emotional intelligence and the importance of emotional intelligence, staying calm and composed in difficult situations, self-awareness,
Right.
self-regulation. I was writing self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, and social skills play a role in being unflappable. But it has to start with us, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, I know a lot of people come, my clients will come to me, and oftentimes their presenting problem is someone else in their environment is making them just out of their mind, right? They're frustrated, they're stressed out, and they want me to help them figure out how to fix them, how to make that person, that situation, that environment change. And very quickly,
Yeah.
I shift them,
I
which,
wrote down my
yeah,
southern thing. That ain't happening, hun. You know,
that
that's
ain't
just
happening. No. And I, you know, I wish, like I talk to, you know, audiences and clients one-on-one alike. If I only had a magic wand, one, I'd be in business for a much shorter period of time, but I would be able to help everyone do everything. But I don't have a magic wand. What I have is our tools that will help you to see the problem differently, because however you've been seeing the problem has got you stuck trying the same solutions you've been trying that aren't working. And if you can just shift the way that you're seeing the problem a little bit differently, then you can start figuring out what you can do to adjust your interventions, your approach to that. And so much of that has to do with, again, how we see ourselves, how we talk to ourselves, how we narrate our daily life and interactions. And sure, other people can remain being incredible pains, but we can still get through so many of those moments so differently and be unflappable when we come from our own inner calm, peace, like you said, self-regulation, all of those things.
And one of the things, I'm on page 120, I'm in that particular chapter, and it says, for things to change, you have to change. Well, yeah. That's kind of
Sorry,
brilliant.
that's the bad news, my friend.
I
But you know, it's funny. You know, when sometimes when people first come to me and they have that awareness, whether they bring it or they get it, they're like, "Oh, this is so painful. This is so frustrating. I can't believe it. It's all me. I've got to do something." Yeah, but see, here's the good news in that is that it's in you. Because if you have to depend on other people to change how you feel about your work, about your life, then you are going to be waiting a good long time, maybe forever, because you're not in charge of what other people do. People decide to change on their own if they do, and you can't do that, but you can shift you. So the good news is it puts it back in your control, and we all love control. And trying to focus our energy on controlling other people is what exhausts us. Focusing our attention on what we can do to shift things, that empowers and energizes us.
It's so easy. Why don't people do this? That's a real question. It's a simple,
It's a
it
good question.
nothing, there's nothing you're
I have
saying, but
analyzed this.
yeah, I don't
Yeah.
get it. You know, it's like, well, I'm in charge of me. I'm in charge of my thinking. I'm not in charge of your thinking. Half the time, I don't even understand what you're saying, let alone thinking. So I'm not going to go down
Right.
that rabbit hole.
We could have an entire podcast just on tackling that question, but
Figured.
from a philosophical, standpoint, I look at it like this. We take the easiest road most of the time. And if we can point outward to something outside of ourselves, that to us seems very efficient. It's out there, right? Because it's no, and I say it's great that you can work on yourself and you're more in control. But it's also more responsibility to look within and to have to assess what parts of you are being triggered or poked at, right? Easier to just blame it on the outside world. The problem is that what you forsake in the work and for that efficiency is not effective, right? It's efficient to blame it on other people. It's efficient to see everyone else as the other and the bad and the wrong and the flawed, but it's not effective because it doesn't change anything. So I think oftentimes as humans, we go for efficient over effective. And that's what Unflappable tries to switch in your mind, is to look at those things a little bit differently so that you can be more effective, even if it's not quite as efficient.
Right. Bridget, do you find when you're poking at somebody else going, well, you, you're really going pointing back at yourself, because what you're upset about is something that they're doing that you do too. You just don't have the wherewithal to go, well, you know, maybe the problem really is me, or the perception is me. Am I going to tolerate this from me? Why would I tolerate this from other people?
It often is. And I always hesitate on this one, that question about, and looking at it like that, as though if I see something else in someone else and I don't like it and it upsets me, it's because it's something in me. And that's it's a common adage that's out there in the self-help world and in the, you know, leadership world. It's, you know, what you see in them is what you see or refuse to see in yourself. And I think that applies a lot of times, but I go to like extreme examples to point out the flaw in that being 100% of the answer. Like if I'm mad at some person in my, state who just murdered someone, and I'm angry that they murdered that person, I don't see myself in them. I'm not angry at them being a murderer because I see a murderous rage in myself, I don't think. But that it doesn't cover all of it. So sometimes it's that, and sometimes it is that that person is like someone who you've had in the past, whether it be a former boss or colleague or employee or family member or friend, who has had you feel that same way and you don't like that. And you weren't able to resolve those feelings in a way that was effective for you in the past. So you don't see the roadmap to get out of it this time either. So it amplifies that old feeling as being even bigger because it's like a bad deja vu. And that's usually what I encounter with my clients, is bad deja vus, and helping people see how to look at that and how to break that down more easily so that they can address it, the old stuff as well as the new stuff, not get them confused, and resolve it so that it doesn't continue and forward itself to another another deja vu moment in the future.
Well, that makes sense. So basically, what you just did was identified common obstacles to maintaining composure, which is difficult. You know, it's hard to be composed all the time. I'll tell you honestly, when I get very quiet, I'm not composed. I am ticked. And you better have another zip code. I am extremely angry.
My kids used to say when my voice got softer, they got more scared.
Say the same things. Yeah. Like, mad, aren't you? Yes, I am. Let's talk later.
Yeah.
When? I don't know. 3 years from now. Not
I think there's this idea that we always go out, but often we go in. And for those of us who have done some of this work on trying to level ourselves, sometimes it does become a very internal process. So I'm watching all of the whatever is going on. I'm feeling the intense emotions that I'm feeling. I know better than to burst out with what I'm thinking and feeling. So I go inward to try to settle or process so that I can come back and be centered and calm and clear when I'm articulating what I'm seeing about a situation. You know, there's this common misnomer, and I've worked with clients on this, like, oh, once I read Unflappable and I do all the things, I'll never be upset again. No, of course, things will upset you, but you will rebound faster and turn the dial down on how high and how hot or upset you get, you'll be able to shift that intensity and frequency with that. You'll be able to enter into situations, but it doesn't mean that you'll never feel a negative emotion again. That's not what healing looks like. You know, we're human beings, so, but we just won't let them hijack us in the ways that they often do and derail us and get us off of our focal point of being successful and taking on new projects and taking on new challenges. They will, all of those things will become less distracting.
Exactly. And listen, I have little hissy fits all day long. They last about a minute and a half, and then I start laughing. You know, I will literally laugh at myself because I look and sound ridiculous, and I know it, but I'm having a good time, and I get over it. But that's how I have to handle it. It's like Denise. And then I'll say to myself in Reba McEntire's voice, "You moron," and off I go. I'm laughing. You know, it's just...
Sometimes it is about letting off steam.
Yeah. Go outside, kick your tires. Yeah, do something, but go back
like
in.
Like a tea kettle.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. So let's talk about overcoming some of the common obstacles. Can you identify some common obstacles that the book covers?
I think one of them, there's so many, right? There's so many things that the book covers in terms of, you know, understanding and managing our stress, which is it's a huge health issue. Understanding where our approach to problems is coming from in our own heads, and that's that intrapersonal section. And then looking at how do we address conflict that arises between ourselves and other people. And I think all of those things are relevant to this discussion of unflappable. But I think one of, you know, if I could pick out, people have asked me what my favorite tools are, and I have so many depending on the context. But one of the approaches is this idea of getting ourselves out of a conflict and into observer role. So often, and we all have egos, ego is not a bad word. It is not an insult, it's not a derogatory term in my opinion. It is something we all have. We all want to feel important. We want to feel smart. We want to feel right. You know, we have all of these ego needs. And the problem is that they get mixed up in other people's ego needs, and then we're fighting without even recognizing what we're fighting over. So one of the most effective tools that people can groom themselves to use is to become the observer in any situation. Like notice what we call in therapy circles, because my master's is in marriage and family therapy, what we call calling the process, which is being outside enough of what's happening to be able to see what is happening versus what is happening to me. And because that is not a power position, right? When we're looking at, oh, that person is yelling at me, or that person took this from me, or that person is threatening this project, or, you know, stepped in front of this and, you know, disrespected me. Then we see ourselves on the receiving end of something versus being able to notice what the pattern might be, what the process might be, which would have created that circumstance in the first place. And with that objectivity, you can be more neutral about it. And the more we're neutral about something, the more we can bring our brains online. Because once our nervous system gets, you know, kind of triggered off in a defense posture, we don't think as clearly. The cortisol is running, the adrenaline is pumping, you know, we're very focused on immediate relief of those symptoms instead of being able to look at long-term practical solutions to that. And so that's really, to me, one of the cornerstones, and it comes up in a lot of different places of being in that observer role, but being able to be that is a power move.
Oh, yeah. And that leads me to my next question, which is, because you've talked about it just a little bit here, the importance of self-care. I mean, we have to exercise, sleep, nutrition, relaxation techniques. I do a lot of breathing because when I'm about to have a real hissy fit, I take myself out of it. I go outside. I take my shoes off. I ground myself in the grass underneath my pecan trees, and I'm doing some dedicated breathing techniques. and then I'm fine.
I love that.
Falls
Yeah,
to the dam.
it's great. You know, and that's so smart, Denise, because what we sometimes fail to recognize is that stress starts in the brain, but exists in the body. So when we're feeling a stressful response, our bodies have kicked into a very basic sequence of operations that doesn't necessarily serve our higher good. And when we are just trying to talk ourselves out of a stressful experience, we are disregarding an incredible contribution to that process, which is our body, is looking at what is our heart rate? What is our breathing rate? How deep is our breath? Where are we holding tension? Do we need to drop our shoulders? Do we need to go outside and stick our feet in the blades of grass? Like, whatever that is. And it isn't just an intervention, because sure, that's helpful when we start to get stressed and we try to come down a notch or two, but it really is more effective when we do that ongoingly, when we are having that as part of our daily practices to be in touch with where our body is at any given time. I remember I was traveling throughout the state, doing a bunch of trainings, and I was talking about this idea. And then I started, you know, because you have to practice what you preach, I started trying to notice, like, am I still holding tension? Like, am I doing that thing that I tell people not to do? And I noticed, Denise, I hadn't noticed this, and I've probably been doing it for decades. I would be driving, and my hand was in, the hand that wasn't on the wheel, sorry, officers, the hand that wasn't on the wheel was in a fist position.
Ooh.
Something as subtle as that. I didn't know why. I don't know why that was. Maybe it was the tension of driving, right? I don't know where it came from, but it was true. And I thought, huh, let me try just relaxing my hands. And let me tell you, the shift in my energetic footprint, like how I felt simply driving down the road, changed. Just focusing my attention on making that hand limp, it made me smile, which then set off another cascade of happy hormones, right? And it allowed me to really be present in my body in that experience. And so simple things like that about getting back into your body really respects the whole person. And I talk about it in the beginning of Unflap of Light. I give a very basic, I mean, I am not a neuroscientist by any stretch, but I give some just basic grounding understanding about how our brains and bodies work that create or unravel some of these problems we find ourselves in when we're being flappable versus unflappable.
And I love that. And listen, I hold my tension in back of my neck and my shoulders. And I'm aware of it, because after a while I'm saying, oh, that hurt. That hurts a lot.
So, you're like trying to cover your ears with your shoulders, you know, you're like, oh, let me get up in there.
So I went to
Amazon. So I'd love the audience. Yeah, I'd love the audience to do this with us, like right now, wherever they are, driving, sitting, to simply notice where your shoulders are and see if you can drop them lower and further back. You can just drop them. And then if you've got your hands, just notice where your hands are. Are they clenched? Or, I mean, if you're driving, please keep your hands on the wheel. But, you know, like drop your hands, like let your hands go a little bit limp. Are you even, some people like hold tension and they're like squeezing their thigh muscle or something, or they're like, they got their foot tensed or something. Just relax it and know that just doing that will change your chemical makeup. This isn't like woo science. This is real legitimate biology, that you will change your body chemistry in a matter of seconds simply doing that.
You can't. And I went to Amazon because even though I was aware of it, I kept hunching. I spend a lot of time as a web developer, and I spend a lot of time at my office, in my office, looking at this giant monitor. And then after a while, my neck hurts, my shoulders hurt. So I went to Amazon and I got these straps that you just basically makes you not hunch. It helps. It's uncomfortable. It ain't fun, but it helps. So I'm noticing that once I trained myself to, you know, sit up straight again, I used to, but I got out of the habit. And now I'm like, okay, that's good. You know,
yeah. And you're probably more relaxed, because when you're tensing and you're trying to like hold yourself in a certain uncomfortable position, you're sending a message to your brain, because we're a beautiful self-regulated homeostatic system. We want to stay in the same place and adapt to whatever it is that we're doing to ourselves. So we find ways to do that. Sometimes those things are for good and sometimes for not. They're simply getting in touch with our body and how that's operating within a system can really help us to manage some of the challenging situations that are in front of us.
Exactly. And I'm telling you, it's uncomfortable, but it does.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, and I started to put it on this morning, but then I went, no, I can do this on my own. And I'm sitting up straight. So yay me.
Look at you. Look at you go.
Oh, no, I'm so proud. I wanted to ask you about the importance of building a support network, because we're not alone. Everything you're talking about in this book, we're not alone. And sometimes we just need that support network for somebody to say, Denise, sit up straight. Okay. I'm sitting up straight. sometimes
accountability partners.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So accountability partners are great for this. I mean, it's one of the roles of a coach. In all the things that I do with my clients, one of my functions is to be that accountability partner, to be checking in on how they're doing on a certain thing, giving them positive feedback when they're moving forward on something, giving them some corrective actions when they need to do something a little bit differently. So it's really helpful to have somebody in your corner or several people in your corner to help you with that. The other thing that I notice that happens a lot that's really helpful is when I'm brought in to do a training for a company, or I'm doing some consulting work with a team, and I'm teaching them some of these tools, and then they, because they're so easy to remember and they have really easy like go-to cues, they start using those words and those cues with one another to reinforce the behaviors, which then makes the whole team more effective. Now, I could have had a coaching client in that team and they might have shared that, but it's even more powerful the more people are doing it. So the more people you can involve in doing what it is that you're doing, how you're doing it, we are mimickers, right? We are kind of that monkeying thing where we want to be seen as mirrors of one another. So when we see people doing things, we tend to replicate those behaviors. So having people who are in our midst, who are also invested in their own personal development, in their own stress relief, and improving the way that they speak to themselves and other people, helps us to reinforce that as well. So it's, what's that adage, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. It's that kind of thing, that whoever we're mirroring in our environment is what is helping us build that community, that accountability, that improvement movement.
And you said accountability, and I have to tell you, one of my favorite chapters is on page 129, and it's compassion and accountability. And you say, I love this chapter. I've got sticky notes all over it. But you say at the very beginning of this chapter, when we approach any troubling situation, it's imperative to hold equal parts compassion and accountability for ourselves and others. Compassion is a word, I have to tell you, I've been hearing this word, reading this word. It's been pointing arrows at me for weeks now. Compassion, compassion, compassion. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But I'm paying attention.
Yeah, there are now workshops on compassion, self-compassion. It's become such a buzzword. And I actually developed this a number of years ago when I was going through my own health crisis. And I was finding myself indulging in self-pity and then overcorrecting to, like a militant-like, doctrine. And I noticed that was what was missing, was this balance between compassion and accountability. And I want to define the terms as I use them for this purpose, is that compassion says, of course. It says, of course, because it recognizes that all of us are exactly where, who, and how we are as a direct and predictable outcome of every experience we've had and decision we've made, whether we've been the actors in some of those issues or been the victim or whatever it is, we are exactly where we can expect to be as a direct and predictable result of all of our experiences and decisions to this point. So it says, of course I'm feeling like this. So I'm coming out of So of course your voice is scratchy. You spent the day in the, you know, in the woods yesterday with all the pollen everywhere, Denise. Of course you're going to be scratchy this morning. That makes sense. So, and then accountability comes in on the other side and says, okay, so now what? So if compassion says, of course, accountability says, now what? And it says that it believes that where we are isn't where we need to remain, that we can have gotten here, but now we have the ability, if we are here because of all those experiences and decisions to this point, that means that the thing that's going to change where we're going is decisions and experiences, right? We can't always control the experiences, but we can control the decisions. And so it's looking at how can I affect this experience myself first and then with others to hold myself in compassion and accountability to be where I am and to look to where I'm going. And this concept, when I talk to audiences and I coach my clients on it, it is one of the basic fundamental truths that we hold in our work together, because it encompasses so many things that we are looking at, which is diving into those compassion moments. And many of the tools are guided in that compassion lane. And then also all of the accountability tools to move us forward from where we are, which may be uncomfortable, into a place that is different.
Love that. And then we go to another favorite chapter. This is, well, the one we just talked about is my favorite chapter. My second favorite isn't, just to be clear, is storytelling. Yeah. And it's the next page. It's 133. And it says, when we adjust how we talk about our situation and the corresponding self-talk, I'm telling you, I get ugly with myself now and then. So I go outside. It doesn't matter if it's raining, I'm going outside. I have to change my mind. But when the corresponding self-talk, we then change our lives. Let's talk about that in depth, if you don't mind.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that I was trained in my master's program in marriage and family therapy was a thing called narrative therapy. And the underpinnings of it basically say that how we tell the story about what's happened to us and where we are and what's happening to us changes how we relate to ourselves and other people as a result. So it's really the basis of that. It's that when we talk about an experience, a couple of things. One, from a biochemical, biological perspective, we set off different hormonal, exchanges depending on what kind of story we're telling and how we're telling it. Are we the hero in the story? Are we the victim? Are we angry? Are we scared? You know, what's happening in that story? And so often we don't even notice that we're storytellers, that we tell stories about any given situation that may be very different from how someone else would tell the story, which means that there are different ways to look at a story. Like I ask audiences this when I do presentations and keynotes. So a raise of hands, how many of you have siblings? And, you know, 80% of the people raise their hand. And then I say, and how many of you would find that if I asked one of your siblings how it was growing up, they would have a very different story than what you tell? And everyone laughs and raises their hand again, because we can all be in the same place and tell a very different story. And so when we find that we are telling a story and painting people, ourselves in different ways, we recognize the power of that story, because we like consistency throughout our experiences. So if we're telling a story in a certain way, it's harder to tell a new and different story later. So being very aware of the way that we're narrating our own experiences and challenging some of those things. And that's what a lot of the intrapersonal toolkit does, is it looks at how we might be coming up with the story that we're telling and just getting real curious about, and what else could be true? What else could be going on? How else might I see this? And recognizing that we have an innate anchoring toward being right over being happy. So we will often stick to a story
and believe it.
Yeah, and that holds us to it, right? And the longer we tell the story and the more we tell the story, the more people we tell the story to, the harder it is to detach from. The harder is, how many of you have had like a disagreement or a series of disagreements with a spouse or a romantic partner, and then you tell your friends, And then your partner or spouse gets better and, you know, you realize that some of it was your mistake and, you know, you come back together and you're good. And now all your friends are like, that jerk, what do you mean? Why are you still talking to them, right? It's because we told a story in a certain way, right? So imagine if you do that for years and you tell yourself and that story, and then you see new data that disrupts that story, your brain is going to want to kick that data out, because it's inconsistent with the story you've been telling. So that idea, and I talk about it in another part of the book about certainty versus curiosity, is having a curiosity stance, to be real curious about what could be going on so that we become more flexible in the way that we tell those stories and that we recognize that we are telling a story to begin with.
One of the things that you say on this particular page, 133, and it's what you're talking about, our views may be built on poorly informed, misleading ideas absorbed when we had no other options to consider. I have to tell you, my brother was a lung transplant. He died about 3 years ago. The year or so before he passed, and we knew his time was limited. He was just not well that last year. He did have 8 extra years of life, though, God bless him. But we got to discussing our childhood. Now, he was 5 years younger than me. And I caught the first bus out when I got out of high school. I was like, gotta go. So I didn't really know.
See ya later.
I gotta, I'm out of here. And I was too. But yeah, you know, I didn't really know him all that well. And then we got to know each other better, much better as adults. And he would tell a story about our childhood. And I'm going, what? What are you talking about? And I would do the same thing. We had no recollection of the same events being even close to each other.
Right.
And I had to go.
And so that operates.
Okay.
Yeah,
now
you operate
what?
Then differently in the world. Yeah. So you operated differently in the world as a result, right? You
right.
saw the world differently. You saw, you know, you developed probably an uncanny sense of independence and, you know, self-reliance, right? Because,
Well, yeah, it's called bitchy, but yes, I like your view.
See how I tell the story. So, yeah, but it is, right? So you developed these tools as a result of how you perceived what was happening, what had to happen. You probably told yourself, I got to get out of here. Well, your brain then says, my reticular activating system says, I have to head in this direction. So we're very survival oriented, and survival is also predicated in our very basic parts of our brain of being very consistent and very everything falling into line clearly, versus having, maybe over here, that might be also true. No, we don't have time for that when we're a survival standpoint. We have to go directly toward the thing that we've decided we're going to go toward. So as we evolve as a species, as we evolve in our own journeys, we can recognize that being more open to different perspectives actually makes us stronger and smarter and better and more successful, and not the other way around.
And I love this part. This is the very last part of that particular chapter. And I don't scribble on books. I think that should never happen. But I do, you know, sticky note. It's just rude. That comes from me living in a library when I was a kid. We were always in the libraries to help mark the books.
Oh, yeah. Same.
Yeah. I have a lot of respect for books. But it says you're the narrator of your own life. Once you become aware that you're always telling a story, and so is everyone else, you can start to challenge these stories so you can remain calm, clear, and confident. And sometimes those are difficult. After I was having these conversations with my brother, I would have conversations with my sister. We would talk about the same exact event. They're like, nope, didn't happen that way. Son of a biscuit. And I'd have to go back. Take a look. Sometimes I was always going to see it my way, but I have to tell you, this is kind of embarrassing. There was one event that I just knew was absolutely true. I was 2 years off.
Wow.
I was so dedicated to this story, but it was 2 years later.
Yeah.
That
and
was
sometimes
embarrassing.
We do. We get these facts kind of stuck in our brains, and we'll fixate on them, and then we'll tell the story. And the more we tell it, the more we believe it. And one of the things about storytelling, and also it kind of ties into the compassion piece as well, is if we are telling a story that's creating the life that we have, so is everyone else. And so when we start getting really compassionate about the idea that we are storytellers and we want to make sense of what's happening in and around us, and so is everyone else, we can notice in a conflict why a story somebody else might be telling, what their motivations for telling that story that way might be, whatever benefits that they're receiving or consequences they're avoiding, that helps. You know, so I just had a conflict come up recently, and I had to look at it. I had to use these tools and say, wow, how could they be coming to this situation? Why are they operating like that? Why are they fixating on that detail? That's only one part of the story. And then I thought, oh, right, because them focusing on that one part of the story might lead them to getting this benefit and avoiding this consequence. That makes perfect sense. And when I can see that it makes perfect sense from their vantage point, it doesn't mean that I see it the same way. I'm just able to see it the way they see it. And in that space, I can see opportunities for me to resolve the conflict differently than me just banging my head up against theirs over and over, trying to convince them to see it my way. Because you probably have noticed this with your brother and sister. The more that they told you you were wrong, the more fixated you got in wanting to be right. Am I right?
No. For sure, right.
Okay, then you are unlike the rest of humanity. I don't even know what to do with you. Yeah,
I just lied on the radio. Sorry about that.
But it's true, right? Like, who likes to be told that they're wrong? I've had a few people in some of my workshops say, oh, me. And I say, okay, well, maybe in some cases, you like the opportunity to be seen as being wrong so that you can go advance something, and good on you. You're better than most of us. But most of us do not like it. Like, no. The child, the younger part of ourselves, like, absolutely not. So we dig in harder, and conflicts become more and more embroiled as a result, because people are telling each other, no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. And we're just repeating over and over in our brains our rationale for being right. And so what if we could just look at it and go, oh, I can see why they think that they're right. We might actually be able to tell that story out loud to that other person. Like, I totally see why you see it that way. Like, I can completely see how you see it that way. Can I share why I see it my way? And then maybe there's some place to meet in the middle.
I'm actually not in a conflict just yet, but I suspect I will be before the day's out. And you just a lot. So thank you. I mean, I just
You're
wrote
welcome.
That down, and I wrote down, it's 10:53 when she said that. I'm going to go back and listen to that. Because it's really been bugging me for about the past week. I've got to get out of this situation. It's a client that I took on that I really didn't want to, but I knew his mom. I knew him. It hasn't been, it hasn't been a good time for anybody. And it's time to let it go, but I don't want to hurt his feelings. I don't want to say, you know, I can't stand you right now, which I kind of can't.
Right.
But I'll get over that. But I've got to make it right, make sure that he understands that, you know, I still have respect for him and his mother, who I worked with for years before she passed away. I just can't do this work with him. Let me turn that around. I won't do this work with him anymore. Right. It's miserable. We're both miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the, and that's actually, I think the next tool in the book, if I'm not mistaken, is nice versus kind. I was just having a conversation with someone yesterday. And this idea that so often, especially, and I think women do it more often than men because of how we're socialized, but we opt for being nice instead of being kind. And nice, frankly, is manipulative. Nice means I'm going to do something for you in hopes that you'll like me and accept me, in hopes that you won't reject me, in hopes that I will garner some favor in your mind, that I will feel good about myself being nice, when inside of me, I'm holding resentments. I'm holding grudges. I'm holding judgment. I'm, you know, casting aspersions on you in my head. I've got a voodoo doll going with pins and all, right? Like, that is not kind.
Okay.
That is very unkind.
You just described my entire weekend. I was having all of these conversations with myself and with my friend who was with me. We were talking about it. And she said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to have to fire him. but I don't want to be ugly about it. I really
But it
don't.
could be the kindest thing you could ever do, Denise, because
It
think
will
about it.
be.
And I want
It
all of
will
the
be.
listeners to think about this. When you are being nice and not being kind to someone, when you are not looking at what is in their best interest, let's say you're doing a project for someone and you hate them and you've done all the inner work to try to figure out how to loosen that, lighten that, look at it another perspective, but you are just stuck. How kind is it to continue to work with them in that way? Are they getting the best of you? Are they getting the
No.
best they could be getting from someone else? They're
They're
not, but we do it
exactly.
because we're trying to be nice and keep this favor. And it's really, if we could all focus on being more kind to one another instead of being nice and recognize, again, we all manipulate our environments. We all have ways that we, you know, we exchange things for other things so that we can feel liked. We have a need for belonging. It's not about vilifying necessarily all of that niceness that we do. It's about getting honest with ourselves of, oh yeah, I'm being nice right now. This isn't kind. let me not fool myself and lie to myself that that's what I'm doing. Because when we do that, we end up not trusting ourselves. And that's when our inner critic blows up, because our inner
Exactly.
critic can tell when we are being out of integrity with ourselves. And
Oh,
so
my inner
being nice,
critic has been stomping on me for a month. So,
yes, see, because you're
seriously.
not living in integrity with yourself, right? And that's our inner critic notices those discrepancies and will jump in on us on those and take us by the jugular, Denise.
Well, and what I've done with this particular client, and he is a very nice guy. And like I said, I loved his mother, but he doesn't, he's sporadic and he's chaotic. And I can't, the work I'm doing or trying to do with him doesn't support that. So what I did, I got home last night and I wrote, and I'll have to rewrite it, but it's basically, and this is what you're going to need from a new team. And I'm telling you, how you can support a new team and support yourself with this, because the stuff, I mean, he just doesn't show up, and I'm supposed to read his mind and I can't read his mind. So, you know, and that's just a, and that is a God's honest truth, but I don't want to say, hey, it's been nice knowing you, gotta go now. I want him to understand that I really do want what's best for him. I'm just not that person right now.
Right. And that is kind. That is kind, is releasing someone to pursue another employment relationship, another consulting assignment, another, you know, personal relationship, so that they can actually live their best life instead of us holding them hostage to us just like slogging through the being nice part and,
Exactly.
you know, really recognize. Where did you go?
I'm sorry. I didn't
Oh, there
want
you go.
to jump on you. The next chapter is another important one. It's called Pivot Power.
Yes. I do love Pivot Power. Yeah, Pivot Power, you know, I came up with a number of years back when I was, I actually did a book called Stuck You, which is looking at the change process. I know. My kids cringed and I said, I guess that's the right title. So it is you period, like university, but you got the indication. So, you know, I looked at three things that are three aspects of ourselves, and it goes back, it touches on a lot of things on emotional intelligence, of three things that are important and necessary to be able to change and move and see new opportunities and make new, you know, inroads in our lives. And those three things are insight, the understanding people and ourselves. And that a lot of that gets dug into here in Unflappable, and understanding how we can see the problem more clearly because we can really look at what's happening versus having all of our blinders on. The second one is distanceability, which is that observer role piece, this ability to create, you know, a perspective on what's happening, to decrease that emotional and reactivity that we have in so many of our exchanges, and be able to look objectively at what might be happening. And then the third is that flexibility, or that curiosity piece, of being able to be different in different situations, in different environments, with different people, be able to challenge our thinking about things so that we can actually move the needle and be different. So those are like, and I go into more detail in the book, but that's really, you know, that's at the core of how anyone is going to take on Unflappable is do you have some insight and are you willing to get more? Can you figure out, or you want to work on how you can be more objective, more in that observer role, and how flexible can you be in your thinking? Can you look at the different tools in Unflappable and look at, wow, that might actually be a better way of doing this thing called life and peopling and working, right? And if you can have those three aspects, you're going to be Unflappable.
And one of my favorite tools, page 160, is and/or.
Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. It says these short yet transformational words reduce rigid thinking, emotional reactivity, which I'm doing right now, I'm trying not to, mm-hmm. and increase personal power through awareness and choice. Do we have time to go through those? We've got about 6 or 7
minutes. Oh, we can. I mean, hey, you know, and or, those are pretty short words that we should be able to. So it's funny, having a background in psychology and looking at how people think, those two words really at their core are addressing cognitive distortions, which is the way that we come looking at a problem and we pick a way of seeing it that may or may not be real, right? And at core is inflexible. So cognitive distortions are things like, you know, amplifying something, making something bigger than it actually is, seeing something as either or, like it's either all bad or all good, those kinds of things. And what and or allow us to do are to use that curiosity muscle and see what else might be happening. So and looks at, this is true and this is true. So, this person that I'm working with is, they're being just a real pain in my rear. And they're also really good at their job, right? So there are two truths at the same moment. It looks at that things are more complicated than one thing. And or allows us to say, this is the thing that's happening, or this could be the thing that's happening. So this person who's being a pain to me at work is just trying to get under my skin, or they're having a really hard time at home, or they don't realize that they're making me as frustrated as they are, or maybe I'm being a pain to them, right? Like you just keep going until you see all these different ways. You know those books where you love books, where you can choose your own adventure. It's kind of like that of saying, okay, so I could go down this road and open this door, or it could be this door, or it could be this door. And it's funny when I've used this in group trainings, the people will come back to me and say they and or each other in the middle of meetings, like, and it becomes this joke, but it allows them to kind of like, you know, they'll say like, yeah, it works, because all of a sudden everyone's, again, that piece that you said in the intro about using humor, not sarcastic mean humor, but humor that kind of lightens, like, it's just not that serious. We could really solve this problem that's in front of us. That approach to things can really help loosen our seriousness that makes us want to be right all the time. And adding like that or to the end of a sentence makes people chuckle and actually go, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, let's look at another option that could be that maybe that's not the solution to the problem. And it allows people to really collaborate better as a team when they can see that that flexible thinking is supported by managers, supported by leadership.
One thing I will ask myself constantly throughout the day is, Denise, is this true? Is this really true?
Yeah.
Often it's not.
Yeah.
Popped into my head and I ran with it.
Right. And even if you can't get, is this true? Because some of us are like, yes, it is. That might evoke a yes or no answer. How much of this is true? How true is this, right? To what degree is this encompassing all of what might be going on here? What might I be missing? And that's a really good question to ask ourselves. I just shortcut it to and or because I find it's easier to remember those words. But yeah, what else could be going on? What could I be missing? how else could I see this? And those are some of the longer phrases that add on to the and or concept.
And they make sense very quickly because we are running out of time, and I hate this, but the gift of attention is so important. Yeah. Stop talking. Listen.
Right. Well, the gift of attention is one of the tools. And what it's talking about is we go where our eyes are, right? So we are, whatever we're giving attention to, that is what is going to grow. So what do we want to spend our time, our focus, and our energy on? And how are we showing that with what we are looking at? So many of us are, you know, not necessarily looking at things with this sense of what I call calm confidence. We aren't looking at things with a clarity of sight. And so we have to really be mindful about what is it that we are investing our energy in, because we will go, again, where our eyes are. There's this part of our brain called the reticular activating system, the RAS, and it goes toward what we put as an intention. So it's not about, you know, a lot of us like the whole idea of manifestation and, you know, the secret and creating things in our lives. Sure, that could be how things are happening. It could also be that our brains are going after what we tell our brains to notice. So if we start talking about, I don't know, I love blue houses. All of a sudden, we just see blue houses everywhere. Well, they didn't change. unless everybody's getting their house painted this week, they've always been there. But now our reticular activating system is pointing those things out and seeking to find those things in our environment. So the same way that our attention goes is where our energy goes.
Exactly. And I'm of the mind that what I'm looking at, I'm creating. Or right. Sometimes co-creating. So you have to be careful what you're really paying attention to.
Yeah, and from a brain science level, you are absolutely correct. I used to tell my kids this, and they used to, I'm sure, want to throttle me. They'd say something, and I'd say, and they were convinced that that was right. I said, if you believe that to be true, that's what is true. Like, I can't. If you believe that you can't, I absolutely agree with you. You can't. Because we create those ideas, because we will find anything to support our conviction, because that's what our brain and our bodies want us to do.
Yeah, can't is a word that I try to never use. I will use won't. Don't. You know, for instance, I don't swim largely because I don't know how, but I don't say I can't.
Yeah.
If I got tossed in and needed to learn very quickly, I think I would. Yeah, but
you'd at least hopefully be buoyant and float. Yeah.
There is that.
Don't count on that though, Denise.
I don't.
Please, from a safety standpoint, yeah.
I know. And yesterday, of course, at the park, I live in the deep south, and you know, I'm not too far from the Gulf of Mexico, and this park is around water. And my dog decided she wanted to go down the embankment. I was like, there's alligators in there. She's like, what's an alligator? Don't go in there. So, yeah. And I'm thinking, okay, if she goes in there, she's on her own, because I'm not going to fight with an alligator. I love her, but not that much.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, I actually saw a video of some guy pulling his puppy out of a baby alligator's mouth. And I thought, baby alligator, maybe.
Yeah, big alligator.
Not a full-size one.
She turned around and went, okay, fine. Listen, Bridget, I sincerely appreciate you being with me again today, and spending time with you is always a pleasure. Before I let you go, do you have any last thoughts to share, and how can listeners connect with you on the web? Where can they find your book?
Well, so I would love them to, if they want a couple extra bonus tools that I have for download on my website, they can go that way to pick up a copy of Unflappable, and that's at drbridgetcooper.com. Sure, it'll be in the show notes. But drbridgetcooper.com, or they can hop on over to Amazon and pick up a copy. What I do ask all readers, if you've read it, please give me some stars on Amazon. They do love that for their algorithms. And if they'd like me to come into their office or to a conference that they're putting on, I would love to share these tools in real time, live with people. And if you're looking for someone to support you on your accountability journey and that compassion resource, please reach out to me. I would love to coach you one-on-one.
Everybody get this book, I'm telling you. So to the
Thank
audience,
you.
as we conclude today's episode, your feedback means a lot to me. And if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. Your input, honestly, is very vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your Partner in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to find Dr. Bridget Cooper on the web and connect with her. And thank you for tuning in, and I will see you next week. Bridget, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Denise. It's always a pleasure.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.